Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Chasing the Sun, the epic story of the star that gives us life by Richard Cohen. We're up to chapter 32, which means we're probably up to episode 35. And this is entitled The Death of the Sun. The last one is Impossible and Beyond, and a fascinating, absolutely fascinating story about science fiction, where I found the likes of Kepler and Johannes Kepler of the elliptical orbit fame, and Winston Churchill, both wrote science fiction. I found Winston Churchill's science fiction. I'm sure to podcast his beautiful 87 pages of science fiction to you soon. Now, goodbye, Rupert. Cole Porter, do I love you? Do I? If the sun should desert the day, what would life be? I don't quite know. Erasmus Darwin, who is the grandfather of Darwin, Lord Pearson, and has really came up with the precepts of evolution. He wrote, the sun sinks on suns, and systems crush, headlong extinct to one dark centre fall, and dark and night and chaos mingle all. That's pretty beautiful, but it, you know, and he wrote these beautiful, he was a real poetical man, but, you know, indecipherable. Now, one of the important things I was going to say is that Herschel imagined the sun as a model of the universe. It's an amazing story. This is sort of overlooked. We're going to read into this. In the final volume of C.S. Lewis' The Chronicles of Narnia, that enchanted kingdom perishes when its sun explodes. At last, the sun came up. They knew at once that this sun was also dying. It was 20 times as big as it ought to be, and very dark red. And in the reflections of the sun, the whole waste of shoreless waters looked like blood. So it must be for all worlds, and it will be for our sun too. Before such time, we may have to endure, if we can, several other horrors. Isaac Asimov, for instance, in his A Choice of Catastrophes, considers whether, with both the sun and the earth slightly on the move from their current orbits, they might collide. He dismisses that possibility. Whether the sun might crash into another star is another matter. The sun is 320 light years from the center of the galaxy, so it's 322,000 light years from the center of the galaxy. 100 billion stars, or let's say 200 billion stars, which orbits at about 155 miles a second, taking a complete 25 passages in its existence. Taking about 200 million years to complete the revolution, which means that it has completed 24 to 25 passages in its existence. It's around, I've just got to remember that the galaxy, it orbits the actual galaxy every, the galaxy spins every, this is sort of half correct. The galaxy orbits, rotates as a scene feature. So if you looked at it and you saw it spinning, the galaxy spinning, it would take 250 million years to transit, but the sun orbits the center of the galaxy every 100,000 years. So the sun is actually racing faster and it's going through the actual light and dark patches are fixed, but the stars within them are particles are moving in and out. So what happens is that we accelerate through the dark patches and decelerate through the light patches. This is something which he really hasn't understood. In this 13.73 billion years of the universe history, that's 13.8 with the Max Planck Institute. So he's, we didn't have the latest satellite out there. Billion years of, or we could say billion years or giga years is the unit, the SI unit of your time. The stars in our galaxies seem to have arranged themselves into orbits that avoid another collision. Yet there remains the possibility of Maverick star or globular cluster of stars changing direction, if not colliding with the sun, passing close enough to alter its orbit, which would surely affect life on Earth. Yeah, well, this is the entire thing of central field things. Things rarely collide if the actual size is much smaller than its field. The field interaction undergoes a collision, but it's not a contact collision. So I don't know how they define collision here. Collision would be sort of catastrophic, like an asteroid impact, but in a sense we are all continuously colliding with our sun, whereas in its gravitational field. And the chance of any such calamity, Asimov admits, is very small indeed, pointing out that anyway we would probably have a million years of warning. However, a drifting black hole, his next category of possible catastrophes, might give us only a few years' notice. In 2005, scientists detected a hole the size of our solar system that has so far swallowed up the mass of equivalent of 300 million stars the size of a sun, although, thankfully, it's about 26,000 light-years away, or about 630,000 times the distance between Earth and the sun. There's something gradually, obviously wrong with those numbers. And I don't know where this should be. Should a mini black hole strike the sun, our star would probably ingest it without major repercussion. On the other hand, there's at least a chance that it could bring the sun to terminal collapse or set off an explosion, or good news, not good news for Earthlings. I don't know why they say all that. So, yeah, there is actually nothing in terms of matter. There's no difference between matter hitting the sun and that hitting the sun. Yeah, I just find it. Asimov goes on to consider a cluster of antimatter and non-shining bodies or free planets, both of which may wander into the sun's path. Disaster effect, but in theory, Britney Spears could win an Oscar. One feels he is ticking off anything at least physically possible, however unlikely. In the decades since Asimov's books appeared, the possibility of Earth being hit by asteroids has been endlessly rehearsed. There are enough in our system to worry about, between 1.1 and 1.9 million, with 5,000 new ones being discovered every month. In October 2010, it was reported that an asteroid almost 30 feet across flew within 28,000 miles above Singapore and near miss. Scientists have predicted that a 1,000-foot asteroid will miss the Earth in 2029, and between 15,000 and 25,000 miles, then reorbit just possibly to score a direct hit a few years later. Probability around 2034. The Earth's atmosphere is torn by various objects ranging from those the size of basketballs several a day to car size twice a year. Currently, NASA's Large Synoptic Survey Telescope is monitoring the heavens for such missiles, and it is here that the sun plays an unusual role. The telescope has a blind spot, since bodies that are either just ahead or behind the Earth are easily lost in solar glare. Oh dear. Sunlight also affects the rotation of asteroids less than 1.25 miles in diameter, as roughly the average distance from the sun. They absorb rays and spin will alter as they accelerate on their axis. Pinballs in a breeze. Pinwheels in a breeze. They break up under the stress, whereas an asteroid travelling towards Earth will divert. To divert it, we need to change its velocity, according to one recent estimate, by 1 millimetre per second per decade in advance. Okay. This is asteroid impact. This is all bizarro. Meteorites hit Earth every year at the rate of one every 7,700 square miles, whatever that means. In February, the Sun magazine ran a front cover headline, "End Time Stalker, Killer Meteorite Heads for US." Due to impact in 2012, the meteor could easily fill the end times prophecy of the four horsemen of the Revelation. According to this powerful authority, the 5,000-foot wide ball of rock and ice is not only massive enough to destroy the planet, it's wrapped in an unusual four-layer cloud of dust debris thousands of miles across. The magazine, however, was equal to the threat, advising readers, if you can afford it, install an air purification system. I This is bizarre. This is just, he's lost the plot here. One way or another, the question of the solar system's stability has fascinated and tormented astronomers more than 200 years. It is a pretty amazing thing, especially Neptune and Uranus changing orbits to move out. Somewhat to the embarrassment of contemporary experts, remains one of the most unresolvable calculations in celestial mechanics. But long before such calculations could be attempted, superstition and ignorance were advancing their own dire predictions. The Scandinavian myth, for instance, the sun will eventually fail, to be followed by 3 terrible years of fillable winter, when the earth is caught in the grips of a bone-chilling freeze, after which comes Ragnarok. Then, when eternal darkness settles, the sun and moon are both devoured, heralding the end of all things. Such a belief touches a raw nerve. Charles Darwin, writing to a friend in 1865, voiced, quote, his own pet horror, the sun will someday cool and will all freezing. The world's passing is often linked to the sun to Mars, not only, of course, in Darwin's day. The source of stellar energy was not known, since nuclear fusion has yet to be discovered. Now that we know that the sun gets its power, and that its stores of hydrogen are finite, we can plot how the end may come. The sun's life has held an exquisite balance. While it is contracting under a gravitational field, the violence of thermonuclear radiation at the core exerts an expansive force, the two cancelling each other out. It can, I suppose you can say that hot plasma has a certain density. That's another way of saying it. And sink, which requires an ever more rapid consumption of hydrogen. At some time, that fuel will run out. A star's photosphere is made of 90% hydrogen and 10% helium, and a mix of 67 elements such as iron, cadmium, sodium, as well as 1,800 chemical compounds reflecting the makeup of the sun was originally formed. Oh dear. Although nuclear reactions will steadily alter the mixture of the sun core, their plasma is compacted to a pressure and temperatures to induce fusion. The larger the star is, the hotter it must be, the more rapidly it must consume hydrogen. The more massive stars than the sun run through their nuclear fuel far more rapidly than does our star, because they produce far higher temperatures, or more higher pressure, I think it might be it. You can have a small star, like a neutron star, white dwarf, it's actually a compressed form of matter. So the temperature is very high, but it's got no surface area to radiate it out. This is all part of a process which has been going on for billions of years and will continue for many billions more. But at least 2.5 billion years ago, the sun had contracted to the diameter of 186 million miles. If the sun is 12,000 kilometers diameter, and the sun is 1.3 million kilometers across, so this is incorrect. Only after did it shrink to the size smaller than the Earth's orbit. Oh, okay, that makes sense. It had contracted in diameter. Only after that did it contract. That does not make sense, because the Earth is 4.8 billion years, and I think he's got this out from rubbish. At some point thereafter, the Earth is formed by coincidence at just about the same time the sun began to radiate light. So, yeah, I don't know why he's talking about that. That time, 2.5 billion years, cannot be correct. The sun continued to contraction, so 186 million miles, we're 150 million kilometers from the sun. Billion, is it billion kilometers? Yeah, we're 150 million kilometers. The sun is 1.3 million kilometers across. And I don't know where that came from, but he's talking about the sun being large. The sun continued to contraction, but not to radiate to signal the end of any time soon. It loses several million tons of matter every second, the mass equivalent to the energy it produces through thermonuclear reactions. Another few million tons is lost in the solar wind and other particle emissions. And I think what it is, it's a good percentage of the sun's energy, because the fusion comes out as neutrinos. It's pretty amazing. Although the sun will eventually cool, it has first to go through a long period during which it actually grows hotter. As the hydrogen converts into helium at the core, the resulting attraction will intensify the sun's gravitational field and raise the inner temperature, so it will be slightly expand. No, I think there's, the inner temperature will increase, so it will expand, but the surface temperature of a star is purely the alpha and wave, the way the energy is transmitted. So if it's hotter and denser, if it becomes less efficient, that surface goes. So the core and surface temperature are really uncorrelated. I don't know how they get this. I will have to give my own talk about this type of stuff. Now, eventually it will get hot and will continue new thermal nuclear reactions. The cores, helium nuclei compounding to form nuclei of the next higher elements, such as carbon, oxygen, and magnesium. No, that's incorrect. And silicon, that's not correct. CNO cycle, which actually just only produces helium. It's the triple alpha produces carbon, and so this is really lost. As the sun swells, becoming a maximum of 256 times as wide as it is today, and 2,730 luminous, it will continue at more intensity from its extending surfaces. It will become a red giant. Okay, so it's 256 times wider than it is today. It'll be a diameter of... the diameter, it's still within the Earth's orbit, because the Earth's orbit is 300 million miles, kilometres. And this is saying that it'll swallow the orbit of Venus for sure. For the next few billion years, the sun will fuse atoms quietly and steadily, only rather than burning hydrogen. Once its principal nuclear fuel starts to become depleted, it will reorganize its structure so it can burn the next most plentiful fuel source, helium. That is correct. To do this, it needs an even higher core temperature, and so the inner regions will shrink and get hotter still. However, at the same time, the outer regions will expand greatly due to the last... The sun is already, if you take it up to the heliopause out around Pluto, it's just that this vaporization, it's been vapored down. Now, its expansion will expand, but it will be like a red atmosphere. So we'd still be able to orbit through it. There'll be a bit of drag. We'd still be protected by a magnetic field. It's sort of like hard to really understand what's going on. It's really poorly explained. However, at the same time, during the last billion years, it will get 10% brighter still, similar to the Earth's surface to 2,000 degrees Celsius easily, hot enough to start melting our planet. As Dennis Overburn paints the scene, skimming over the flame tops of this giant, the bare, burnt Earth will produce a bulge in the sun, but friction will cause the bulge to lag as it tried to follow the Earth. The gravitational tug from the bulge will slow the Earth and cause it to spiral inward, where the friction from gases and the sun expanded atmosphere will slow it even more. Then it could go down into the sun. That's exactly right. So that's exactly how you get sort of super tidal forces when you're close to a big body of water. According to scientific consensus, we can look forward to about 5.7 billion years of some kind of life on our planet, but not human life, which will have a far shorter span. A long range of enemies will be heat and the lack of carbon dioxide. Half a billion years from now, the carbon dioxide concentration will be too low for most plants to continue photosynthesizing, and the Earth's average temperature will be above 120 degrees Fahrenheit, whatever that means. I do remember that 40 minus 40 is the same in both scales. Why is the amount of carbon dioxide disappearing? I can't see why that's so. Because the carbon dioxide is a super trace element at the moment. But I can't see, there's no loss mechanisms that are described for it. Over the next billion years, after the extinction of plants, the atmosphere will fill with steam, as did the Earth's birth and the bombardment of intense sunlight. 2.5 billion years from now, the last of all molecules will have disappeared from the Earth. It will be a hot, dead world covered by molten rock. I'd agree with that. It could conceivably escape being engulfed like Mercury and Venus, both of which have been swallowed up by the Sun as it reaches the greatest extension of its red giant. The most recent research suggests that although the Earth is the borderline between being engulfed and surviving, the former fate is more likely. But if it did remain out of the Sun's great swollen bulk, the enormous heat would receive would likely vaporize it. Should the Earth actually escape being engulfed and vaporized, what would it mean for us? Would human life even be an option? One scenario is suggested that what happened to a planet in the neighborhood galaxy. About twice a month, we discover an extrasolar world. This is bizarre. Okay, there's a footnote here, but I can't see where this is from. Oh, yeah. In 2007, came across the Earth-like planet called V391 Pegasi, a gas giant at least three times Pegasi. Bookmarkers William Hughes, on learning of such a planet had been discovered, cut the odds on the existence of extraterrestrial life from 1,000 to 1 to 100 to 1. For them to pay out, the Prime Minister had to confirm proof of such life officially within a year of being the bet being placed. Oh dear, well that's per year. Massive Jupiter. Orbiting about 150 million miles from a faint star in the constellation Pegasus, which is the same distance. The star blew up as a red giant and lost half its mass, but it did not destroy the planet. Maybe V391 Pegasi can survive, and so might Earth. Look, my overall question is, it's not in a neighbouring galaxy, that's impossible. As for other possibilities, such as it must suggest, there's at least I do like how he introduces Isaac Asimov in the chapter before. So if you haven't listened to this, you don't know that Isaac Asimov came as a journal of, I think, 30 ways the Earth is going to die and just talked his way through it. If humanity survives those billions of years, it will... Well, I don't know. We less, you know, that's thousands of years of evolution. We won't be human as we know it. The escape may become possible. It's not only will we need to construct timetables for various stages of the Sun's demise, but at the same time we must look for ways in which to leave our planet and move away from the expanding Sun. A particularly dangerous time for mankind will be at the end of the first red giant phase, when the Sun may become so luminous and helium fuses in a gigantic explosive flash. This is called the helium flash for Isaac. But, I mean, I think Cirrus A is going to flash. I think we're going to have some problems. What we got? It starts at 10. Do you think 9:30? Oh no! So 10 past 9. 9:20. Okay, Dale. There is these things that when it goes through a phase into between the stable, it goes through super heat and super these. It goes through fuses. So you've got helium flash, carbon. Every new fuel that burns, the actual poisoning, build-up of poison for its burning takes a while to go. And you get the opposite stuff with, Chernobyl was similar to it. So Chernobyl had a build-up of xenon 125, which is a neutron poison, which is xenon 125 is a decay of uranium fissures. It produces a certain amount of xenon gas, this 125. This 125 is a neutron poison. So what happens is that you get a lot of fusion, build up of the poison, it pauses a while, and then you know that the nuclear reaction, there's going to be a neutron flux afterwards when this disappears, when this decays. So there's a lot of things happening in nuclear reactions which make them unstable to go through in time scales. Now, how Chernobyl happened is just boggles the mind. Okay. Another period of jeopardy will occur as the sun sheds its upper layers, thus diminishing its mass and weakening the gravitational field. It will loosen its grip on the remaining planets, including ours. No longer so closely tethered to the planet orbital path, they might intersect each other's orbits and even collide with the sun. At this point, I am tempted to seek refuge in Woody Allen's take on the forecast in the future. I thought to myself that if our great golden star suddenly exploded, this planet would fly out of orbit and hurtle through infinity forever. Another good reason for always carrying a cell phone. But all is not necessarily lost. Human ingenuity is almost endless, and we've already researching practicalities of moving to another planet in our solar system, or to one of its satellites, or moving outside the solar system altogether. One possibility, right as it may be, is the use of a series of small nuclear bombs to propel a starship. Such charges would be exposed in sequence, so that the spacecraft would ride on a nuclear flash after either on a permanent orbit or away from Earth to somewhere more habitable. it's a number of Gs. Now, the thing is that we're at 9.8 metres per second, and there's pi by 10 to the 7 seconds a year, which just means that a year of Earth's gravitational acceleration gets you up to a relative speed of light, in your view. Now, this is one of the great things, is that there is a limit on the speed of light, but there's no limit on how fast you can think you're going. I really should talk about this. I think that's stupid. President Obama had already announced a goal of landing astronauts on an asteroid by 2025 as a precursor to a human mission to Mars. Another recent idea outlined in the 2001 paper by Don Kovansky and George Lungan of the University of California, Santa Cruz, and Fred Adams of the University of Michigan is the same way that space probes can boost their trajectory by playing gravitational pinballs with Venus and Jupiter and Jupiter in order to flung outwards, so we, or some version of us, could bring about irregular encounters between the Earth and a comet or asteroid, thus widening our orbit and propelling us further from the Sun. Yeah, I think that seems logical. All that is required is for the asteroid to be about 62 miles in diameter to fly past the sun, transfer some of its orbital energy. The asteroid would then move out to encounter Jupiter, acquire more energy, and a subsequent encounter pass onto us. Thus, it would be about as likely as moving an aeroplane by having a bumblebee go past it every 10 years. Even scientists busy developing scenarios say we're not advocating them as policy. One wonders why Arthur C. Clarke would have made of such ideas. Yeah, that's just sounds insane to me. The entire thing sounds so insane. At least we can take solace from the fact, skeptical as the science themselves are, we're talking of so many million years hence, and the technologies that will be available then impossible to predict. While the Earth may not survive indefinitely, mankind may outlive its destruction. If we assume for a moment that we do manage to leave the Earth on a nuclear-propelled starship or some other vehicle of the future, where will we go? On March 2009, the Kepler telescope was launched. It detects planets outside our solar system that have roughly the same size, conditions, and distance from the star as Earth. By December of that year, planet J, we have discovered so many planets, it's embarrassing. J1214b was found at 2.7 the size of Earth, orbiting a star smaller or less luminous than the Sun. It was also comparatively near to our solar system, about 48 light years, and was water rich. So these are all important things. And so I'm going to have to finish this at some other stage. So we are, obviously, it's good that he did a solar system. Now, in terms of time here, I don't have very much time to get there. So I will have to read. I'll leave the mark of where I am at 2. Thanks a lot for listening. One means of making such a planet humanly habitable already has a name, terraforming. It may even be possible, since by the time the Sun has begun to expand sufficiently to start cooking the Earth, enough eons will have passed that we should have had the technology to establish ourselves on hundreds of such extrasolar worlds. As H.G. Wells wrote, quote, "There's no way back into the past. The choice is the universe or nothing." His fellow novelist, Tom Wolfe, writing on the 40th anniversary of the man's landing on the moon, asked, "When do we start building that bridge into the stars? We begin as soon as we are able. And this is that time. We must not fail its obligation. We have to keep alive the only meaningful life we know." Do we? I question, do we have to? What's so important to do it? And the sort of second thing is that I don't think people really understand the space distances. This is a footnote. A recent astronomy paper has concluded the probability of finding an exoplanet with a habitable nearly identical to that of the Earth is by 20 to 64, is 95%. The astronomers currently estimate there is an astonishing 2 by 10 to 11 planets. So that's 100,000 million planets in our galaxy that could support human life. Over 200 billion, although some experts are persistently believe that the Earth may be the only true example. But then the number of possible other universes is said to be 10 to the 100, or multiple. Good God, of course we won't be able to get there. Not that we should underestimate the extraordinary challenges involved. Should we wish to settle another planet in the solar system, highly unlikely, as none of these are capable of supporting life. We know that Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune will remain circling the Sun even after it's collapsed. And although their orbits will expand, it will not be much less than double, so they will not be moving conveniently near to us. Even if such a planet hopping were to turn out to be viable, it is far more likely that such time would have established structures in space capable of supporting large numbers of people, each community ecologically self-sustaining and independent. I think that is the most likely thing, if you can build a space, the entire thing is without gravity, what is the meaning of life outside Earth? You're out there in space, you're going to have a system and it's not going to evolve more. You're going to have, whereas here we've had the dinosaurs. If the dinosaurs, there'd still be dinosaurs on a spaceship. Such scenarios are not so much science fantasy as science forecast. The astronomer Carolyn Porco voiced the current orthodoxy when she wrote, "Humanity's future need not be confined to mere survival on our home planet. Other worlds beckon, we know how to reach them, and we will once more be outward bound. This won't be a space race so much as a global exodus undertaken by the international community." Oh, sure. There could be no better way to say. Now, this is interesting that there's South American indigenous communities which have looked around and said, you know what? We're not going to produce any more children, and they produce no more children. Isn't that a profound statement? Michio Kaku, in his book Physics of the Impossible, tells us the physicists have now demonstrated that the law that prevents time travel is beyond our present-day mathematics. Statements about what is possible and impossible have to take into account technologies that are millennia to millions of years cannot prove impossible. Well, I don't know, he's such a wanker, that person. Although we may be able to dodge catastrophe, in what form, who can say, because the length of time involved is so great that human race will likely be been succeeded or will have replaced itself by an entirely different species. The sun will not. Eventually its surface will cool to a point where it glows red hot rather than white hot as its early days and enters a second red giant hood. Once hydrogen fusion is no longer the main source of energy, it will maintain itself for only a comparatively short additional period. It enters a brief, unstable phase of diminishing energy returns as it depletes its helium and goes on to burn progressively heavier, scarcer elements. Beryllium, no, it doesn't. That is not true. Beryllium, boron, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen. I don't think we're going to be strong enough. I'll have to reread it. Each one for a shorter period. The ability of this new giant to keep itself distended against the pull of gravity will falter, and it will begin to collapse, shrinking and expanding before shrinking for one last time. Well, it's not so much collapsing, it's just that the gravitational field gradient increases. The greater the mass, it's not so much shrinking. Sun will become lighter, its outer layers blowing into space and form a much denser solar wind. It will not be large enough to explode violently. There will be no danger that within a few hours, a fury of the entire solar system will be scoured of life. It will simply contract to a white dwarf, a tiny, shrunken cinder, probably smaller than Mars, but with a density of 2 tons per cubic centimeter. Where a teaspoon is a matter, it would weigh as much as a Rolls-Royce, leaving behind almost a thin film as its satellite, making itself a planetary nebula. Oh, that's rather sad. Once a white dwarf, it will be a dense ball of carbon and oxygen, no more than a dot, which is correct, possibly carbon and oxygen, but it's not going to be go up to things before above it. Seen from the satellites of Jupiter, supposing mankind pitched tents there, it'll be only 1/4,000th as bright as the sun appears now. Will deliver but a fraction of that energy as it fades away for the rest of time. Conceivably, long before the moment the white dwarfdom comes, future space settlers will have developed some form of hydrogen fusion power stations so that it would be independent of the sun. More likely, they will be have left the solar system altogether. As for the sun itself, as one writer envisions the last days, at 10,000 degrees is a pinprick of white light. It will continue to shine for billions of years, illuminating the giant gas clouds from the sun expelled from the outer layers to form a glorious multicolored nebula of our sun's tombstones. I don't think there is evidence that nebula lasts more than, say, even a few thousand years. You know. If so, it would be full of nebula. Not quite. The final stage is yet to come. In that long, drawn-out death, as the sun cools, it becomes a black dwarf. Well, yeah, but there's Earth planets circling around it. It will not detonate to a supernova again. It is too small, nor will it become a black hole through the implosion of any other means. Our great, terrible, even lovable companion will simply dwindle away, a dark cinder of degenerate matter that's just drifting in vacuum. It's a life-giving journey done. It's beautiful English, and the important thing is that the key thing to hear is understand the word degenerate matter. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.